Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be addressing what I perceive as the cream of the attendees at this meeting of the Philadelphia Society. Something less than 100%, but the purer for that. The cream includes even my own wife, whose ability to avoid hearing me speak is legendary. But one must be possessed of either a staggering ignorance or an absolutely blinding ego and self-confidence to come down to Dallas in Professor Hutt's backyard to talk about unions and collective bargaining. He said it all. He said it brilliantly. And he said it half a century ago. They didn't listen to him then. Even though his warnings at the time preceded our own adoption of labor laws against which he was warning. He's a prophet who managed to be without honor in his own country and ours as well, to the misfortune of both of them. But perhaps by now, we standing up here today, helped by a change in the context about which we're going to be talking, standing as we do, on Professor Hutt's shoulders, we'll get a new hearing for ideas which we must all confess are his, which are more valid today even than when he expounded them half a century ago, for they have been overwhelmingly borne out by the evidence. The title of the session, the overall title of the session, as you heard, was Thinking the Unthinkable, which suggests a certain air of revisionism. And for several years now, there's been an acknowledgement on both sides of the bargaining table that American labor is at some sort of crisis or watershed. Evidently, Irving Brown couldn't bear to hear that because I do not see him among those present. And even Arnold Bikman seems to have slipped out. Membership as a share of the workforce has been declining. The employees of many of our new enterprises are of a sort that are not traditionally very easy to organize. Employers, some with their backs against competitive walls, have grown more resolute and sophisticated in warding off unionization. They have also, some but not all, grown more resolute and sophisticated in taking and winning strikes, which tend to occur when they resist higher labor costs or increasingly attempt to cut back on contracts which have shown to be intolerable under competitive conditions. On top of all this, organized labor itself, the AFL-CIO for the most part, has lost a great deal of its political clout. Now, some of the discussion about labor's plight centers on the possibility of new directions for labor unions. It's suggested that the traditional adversarial stance between labor and management, reflected in, if not indeed fostered by our labor laws, in which Hutt calls outrageous, and he's right, has become outmoded. It's suggested, but not yet very loudly, that more collaborative relationships between union and management, employer and employee, are the necessary wave of the future in trade unionism, if we are to be able to successfully make it happen. We all know confrontation is a way of life. When I found myself in discussions like this, particularly last year at the Mont Pelerin meeting, I've tended to frame the issue for the AFL-CIO hierarchy in these terms. Well, American unions set about making institutional and tactical changes, aiming at a less adversarial, more collaborative mode. Or will the AFL-CIO simply hunker down and wait for the next Mondale type to get elected, under whom their political fortunes would presumably improve dramatically? Answers to the question of change versus business as usual have been coming in, and the returns are running heavily in favor of business as usual. Lane Kirkland, in his Labor Day message, regaled his troops with a catalog of the evils visited upon them by the Reagan administration, starting with the air controller strike. And then he told them Well, visited on them not just by the Reagan administration, but by the inept and wicked employers of the country. Then he ended with a all these abuses will be remedied, and the resurgent labor movement will lead the way. Just as unrepentant, just as resistant to change, and rather more menacing was the director of organization of the AFL-CIO in his Labor Day message when he hurled these thunderbolts at management. If they want war, then it is war they will get. And he added, workers may have to once again take to the streets to defend their right to organize. Now, it's worth remarking as I hurry by that these remarks were occasioned by what Mr. Kistler, the director of organization of AFL-CIO, viewed as the intolerable tendency of some employers to resist union efforts to organize their employees, even when they did so within the limits of existing law. This tendency to persecute those who will not yield to prosecution has a kind of historical exposition flavor to it. In a calmer tone, just as resistant, however, to organic change, is organized labor's chief academic spokesman, my favorite, James Medoff. Professor of economics at Harvard, Medoff offered his own solution to what he saw as labor's chief problem. Now, labor's chief problem, by the way, did not include overachievement in the bargaining process somehow. No, he saw labor's chief problem, number one on his list, its public image. Its other problems related to its spotty record in recent years in organizing the unorganized. And Professor Medoff had several strategic suggestions to cure that. Now, Professor Medoff's reality may not be everybody's, he being of the view, not universally shared outside of the circles in which Medoff moves, that, as I'll quote him, unions have in general been a positive force in society by, among other things, quote, increasing economic efficiency. Well, as the Duke of Wellington said on that famous occasion, if you believe that. Medoff subscribes to the theory first advanced, to my knowledge, 25 years or more ago by Schlichter, Healy, and Levinash at Harvard, and again a dozen years ago by my friend David Feller, the brilliant ex-general counsel of the Steelworkers Union, that unions, by their presence and their power, force managers to become more efficient, and so they are good for the enterprise. I call that the heart attack theory of labor-management relations. You know, you've heard people say, I had this heart attack and I had to change my lifestyle, and now I'm eating differently and I feel better than I ever did, so I'm glad I had the heart attack. Duty proposition. Another academic friend of big labor was more down to earth. Professor Emeritus Jack Barbash of the University of Wisconsin, who was one of big labor's big stalwarts when he was on Capitol Hill, writing in the Harvard Business Review last summer, saw what he described as alarming signs that the balance of power had shifted from unions to employers. I think Barbash is too easily alarmed, and certainly too soon alarmed, as I hope to demonstrate in the next couple of minutes, while I'm yanking this program back onto its time schedule. First, though, I'd like to hack away at some underbrush. I was sort of hoping Arnold would have remained for this because this is an olive branch from me to him. There's a tendency, understandable enough perhaps, among labor's friends to hurl the dread charge of anti-union at anybody who suggests legal communities. Labor unions are in need of reconsideration. And the problem, I think, is that the two sides are not asking the same questions. They're not proceeding from the same assumptions, perhaps not even from the same values. If one deeply believes that a strong labor movement is an absolutely indispensable element of a free society, then one is unlikely ever to ask the question, is it really? Or ask, are labor's powers and privileges justifiable in practice over time? One will simply assume that any effort to diminish those powers and privileges is an assault on the good and therefore, by definition, evil. If, on the other hand, one does not share that theology, one is inclined to raise questions concerning the desirability of laws which foster unionism and permit monopolistic practices in the labor and product markets. One dares to question the utility, in an economic sense, of a unionism which exists chiefly to push wages above what the market would call for. One wonders whether any proof can be adduced that our labor laws did in fact make the contributions to industrial peace and progress that were promised. I've heard the argument advanced by that the pro-labor legislation, or on behalf of the pro-labor legislation of the New Deal, that much interference with the market was acceptable because it would lead to a greater good economically. The societal effect was rather muted, political effect not heard at all. But even if one accepted the premise, has the thesis not by now been disproved in the event, as Huck told us it would be? Or is it not worth an inquiry, at least, concerning what benefits the larger society derived from wages being forced above market levels, above what productivity could pay for, above what competition demanded? What has been the compensatory benefit? Temporary good times for some workers, surely, dues heavy union treasuries buying political influence. But what of the economy at large? What of the society at large? What compensatory benefit has this massive interference with the market provided? Has it even produced industrial peace? Are these questions not worth studying, especially if we do so in light of the fact that value judgments are involved and differing premises yield differing results? I suggest that merely recognizing these basic differences would make an enormous contribution to the policy debate which we are here today proposing should take place. I insist, however, that it's necessary for me to do so, that there is a vast difference between eliminating unionism altogether, which I do not advocate, and which would not probably be constitutionally acceptable in any case. The difference between that and requiring unions to stand in the marketplace on the same footing as other institutions in our society. And to those who respond to that suggestion with the cry that this really would mean doing away with unions, I suggest they are making a profound admission against interest when they thus argue, in effect, that without their special privileges, unions couldn't make it in a free society. In any case, it is clear at the moment that the climate, as I say, among big labor is business and its spokesmen is business as usual. What does this mean at the enterprise level? Well, for one thing, as you all know, it means that American unions will continue to be a drag on the American economy. Wage levels will continue to be, in many situations, too high to permit effective competition with what are euphemistically called our trading partners. There is absolutely no sign that I can see that the auto workers union, for example, is prepared to recognize that they not only price themselves out of the market, but that they are continuing to do so. The current Chrysler strike, aimed at getting back the last of what they gave up as a condition of the bailout, is a shocking illustration of the business-as-usual mentality. Ought the union, that union, any union, have the power to cost Chrysler what some estimates say is $16 million a day in order to force Chrysler wages back up to the non-competitive industry level? You can answer that question economically or sentimentally. I submit you can't do both. United Airlines, Wheeling Steel come to mind as a couple of other cases where compensation versus competition was the issue. They raise a question which, like all of the others, Professor Hutt raised many, many years ago. Should any group have the capacity to wreak that degree of harm in pursuit of private interests? Or is the strike, as he then asserted, an intolerable weapon in a civilized era, whatever its objectives? Can we afford to ignore a question which has been raised in those very same terms by two such disparate commentators as Bill Hutt and Abe Raskin of the New York Times, the preeminent labor journalists of our time? I recently had occasion to observe a strike in a town near where I live in California. It involves a couple of companies in the frozen food industry, and came about because the companies faced with ruinous competition from other states and from Mexico, where spectacularly lower wages prevail for essentially the same kind and quality of work. Companies sought to cut the union wages in the new contract negotiation. Cut them substantially by about 30% on the average. The workforce, led by the Teamsters, rejected the wage cut proposal and a strike ensued, and then the pattern became distressingly familiar. Squabbles over numbers of pickets became court proceedings. Picketing grew increasingly rough as the companies tried, at a fairly modest level so far, to continue operating. Buses carrying workers into the plant were stoned. Charges and countercharges flew, as did fists and brickbats, and most recently, Molotov cocktails. Working employees were threatened and followed home, otherwise arrested. Just before I left, the violence escalated to arson, and the firemen were stoned when they responded. The great tragedy is that the strikers clearly feel that they have some kind of right to enforce the right, and they're supported by violence. So they feel ill-used by every police interference with their unlawful conduct. The role of violence, the more or less routine, almost legitimate weapon in strikes, has been documented over and over by our commentators, chief among them the scholars at the Wharton School, who have done definitive studies on both strikes, violence and strikes, and welfare for strikers. Too often strikes succeed and companies are badly wounded, sometimes mortally, for ends which are not perceivably justifiable, and for lack of that degree of law enforcement which permits employers to exercise the rights which they have under existing law. Meanwhile, new tricks are being added by unions to the industrial warfare. They tend to exploit labor's immunity from the antitrust laws. Specialists in public and corporate affairs on the union side organize boycotts and bring sophisticated pressures to bear on the struck company through members of its board of directors who may be vulnerable to, or at least feel that they are vulnerable to, or at any rate have no disposition to resist such union pressures. Everybody remembers what happened to J.P. Stevens a few years ago. A recent outrageous example is the United Methodist Church urging its 9 million members to boycott Campbell's soup. Now, is this because Campbell's soup is atheistic or anti-Methodist? No, it's not. Is Campbell's soup locked in a struggle with some union for whom the Methodist Church feels sympathy? Wrong again. The object of the boycott by the Methodist Church is to force Campbell's, to force the tomato growers from whom it buys tomatoes, to recognize the Farm Workers Union, which has been trying to organize their employees for 7 years. Now, I suggest to you that any system under which that kind of dictatorial, arbitrary power is permissible, and it's permissible to the church not because it's a church, but because of the ridiculous definition of a labor dispute and what is permitted in labor disputes under our labor law, that sort of thing can go on. I suggest a new, listening to that Campbell's soup case and some of the others I described, a new truism to replace the false one, labor's disadvantage, which Hutt demolished long ago and which I have reason to hope he may be re-demolishing soon again. I suggest a concept of management's disadvantage to describe our tilted system of labor law and labor policy. Should we continue to ignore that in much of what it does, from pattern bargaining to sympathy strikes to product boycotts, labor is permitted to engage in conduct which would be criminal restraint of trade if engaged in by a businessman. I conclude with a quote from Professor Richard Epstein, just so you don't think that I'm being too far out on my own. of the Chicago Law School, who in a seminal article in the Yale Law Journal, which I read recently, although it appeared 2 years ago, the article was titled "The Common Law of Labor Relations, A Critique of New Deal Labor Legislation," and he concludes as follows, and so do I. "What is needed is a greater concern with the institutional structures. At present, there may be little prospect for the repeal of basic labor legislation, and there is none for its constitutional overthrow. The possibilities of incremental changes, however, are always present. An opportunity for a major overhauling might even follow an intensive re-examination of the subject. The New Deal brought forth major labor law legislation, but as a normative and intellectual matter, it did not conclude the debate on the nature and functions of labor law." Thank you.